Hi, you're listening to Hungry Magazine from Chicago, Illinois.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hey there, welcome back to another edition of Hungry Magazine. I know it's been a while since I released a podcast, and for my legions of fans, all 7 of you, I'm truly sorry. As always, you can download the interviews at www.hungrymag.com. Anyways, I've been cooking, writing, and still eating around, even though I haven't been recording as often. And I hope to be bringing you a lot of interesting interviews over the next few months. Today's interview is with Adam Seeger, the general manager, sommelier, and bar chef mixologist at Nacional 27, a Nuevo Latino spot here in Chicago. Along with fellow mixologists like Francesco LaFranconi, Eben Clem, Dale DeGroff, Tony Abuganum, among others, Adam is really blurring the lines between the kitchen and the bar. He's leading a wave of mixology that focuses on creating balanced cocktails from farm-fresh, locally sourced produce with homemade liquors, aromatic infusions, and spiced drink rims. Adam's really changed my outlook on the cocktail. A month ago, I'd be ordering up my standby of Maker's Mark and Coke, but now I'm questioning bartenders on whether they're using fresh juices. Adam and I met at Chicago's Green City Market so I could see how he constructed his weekly market cocktail list. This interview is a little more organic than most of the ones I do, because we occasionally stop to admire the awesome product of the market. You'll hear Adam mention constructing drinks around cachaça, a cane sugar-derived spirit similar to rum. At the time of our visit, he was planning drinks for cachaça tasting at Nacional 27. Finally, there's some wind sound in the background of the interview. I apologize, as this was my real first foray into recording in the great outdoors. I'll work on that for the future. Adam's approach to mixology is to think about food and translate that to a liquid form. A lot of this philosophy comes from his time working with Rick Tramonto and Gail Gand at True, and Thomas Keller at the French Laundry. Adam was even hired as the pre-opening GM of Keller's New York outpost, per se. Adam worked for a brief time at Chez Julien, a Michelin-starred restaurant in Strasbourg. We started out talking about that experience.
That was when I was at Cornell. I had a business French class, and the professor took... She took one student per year and set him up with a stage for one of the alums in Strasbourg. And I did that the first summer. And actually, this place, Chez Julien, I walked by it every day on the way to work. And it's just this beautiful, beautiful little restaurant. It's right on the canal. Looked over the cathedral and the Palais de Rohan. It was amazing. And saved her my money, had a day off, put on my suit, and went in and had lunch. And I had, everywhere I went, I had a notepad. And on one side of it, anything I saw in French that I didn't know what it meant or I read menus, I'd write it down. I'd go home at night and I would translate it. And then on the other side, it was things in English that I wanted to learn how to say in French. And so, and I'd also write down ideas, things I saw. So I was having lunch alone, business suit, writing notes, and they were in the middle of their Michelin inspections. So they thought I was a Michelin inspector. So I got like... the most out of control, best service I've had in my life. And at the end, I asked to meet the chef, and they made all these excuses. And I had no idea they thought I was Michelin or whatever. And got to meet the chef, and I thought it was hot shit because I just met Julia Childs. We'd started a AIWF chapter at Cornell.
What's AIWF?
American Institute of Wine and Food.
Okay.
It was the first student chapter that she started up there. So I thought I'd name drop, and he goes, Je sais seulement les chefs français. I only know French chefs.
Uh-huh.
Julia who? I'm like, all right, this conversation is not going well at all.
No.
And then I said, you know, I'm a student at Cornell. I hadn't heard of Cornell. You know, he's heard of Lausanne. That was it. And I said, well, it's kind of like the Lausanne Hotel School of the States. And so then, thank God, somehow South Louisiana came up in conversation. That was from Baton Rouge. And the chef had just gotten back from New Orleans, and he was amazed how European a city was and food passion and everything like that. And so he ended up inviting me to come back and spend some time with him in the kitchen on my next day off. So the other restaurant I worked from like 6 a.m. to usually 3 p.m. So next day came Chef Weitz, Chef Knife, everything showed up, and pretty much just kind of moonlit there for the rest of the summer. I'd work my regular job in the morning and then I'd go there, and he showed me everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one turn a night. They bought all their ingredients every day, did all their own butchering, grew their own herbs. I mean, it was just, that was just seeing the level that you know, food could go to.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of take all of those influences and then kind of try and think about that.
You knew early on that's what you wanted to do because you went to hotel school management at Cornell, right?
Yeah.
So where did that come from? As a kid, were you a big...
Oh, I started cooking when I was like five.
Yeah?
Yeah. Cooking and gardening, I just loved, you know, eating. And I love the notion of... The first thing I made was a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese when I was five.
Nice.
And it was just... I was so cool because, like, here's this box of, like, stuff and then some milk and some margarine. And then, you know, it tastes great. And it was just cool to take, like... And then,
did you go through, like, the iterations of, like, refining the mac and cheese
when
you're growing up?
Yeah.
It was, like, throwing a little bacon, you know, throwing some other cheese, you know?
Yeah.
It was always a thing for me, too.
Oh, yeah. Really, the best, though, is if you reduce the cheese sauce a little bit, you let it boil a little bit, so it gets a little bit more intense. And then, like, lots of fresh cracked pepper on it.
Nice.
It's still, like, my comfort food.
Nice. Yeah, I think it's most people's comfort food, right?
Yeah.
Although I've been joking that, you know, it's funny you don't grow up with these, traditional ethnic comfort foods like pho or, you know, but now it's like those are like my comfort foods too now, you know. It's like I'd love, there's nothing like a nice steaming bowl of Vietnamese pho or a banh mi sandwich, you know, and it's so weird how it doesn't have to be part of your youth, but when you come back to it, you're always going to go to the mac and cheese, or, you know. For my wife, it's her mom's chicken noodle. But,
totally.
Yeah.
So where... Cachaça, just speaking, I kind of think about what spirit I'm using is kind of like a separate thing about your protein. So you're going to kind of be thinking different things, looking at different produce if you're using chicken versus beef or veal or lamb. So because cachaça is basically sugarcane based, kind of go more along the lines of fruit where if I was doing something, say, with gin... I love gin with herbs. I love gin like with cucumbers, with melons, tequila, obviously.
So with the gin, you're playing off the aromatics that are already in there.
Uh-huh.
With the cane sugar, are you using that residual sweetness to sweeten the fruit, or what's the thought?
Yeah, I just find that the flavors just combine better.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've got a drink, we call it the Mojitonico, mm-hmm. and it's kind of the concept of a mojito. But we use, for it, I use Tanqueray 10. It's the only gin that uses fresh botanicals and fresh citrus. So actually, I love it like in a Cosmo. I think it makes a really interesting Cosmo.
Most people use dried?
Most people use vodka.
Oh, in Cosmo. No, but I'm saying the gin.
Oh, all other gins are dried botanicals except for Tanqueray 10.
Sure.
But like, I love that, and it's basically a mojito, but extra lime, and then tonic water instead of soda. Another one is Hendrix. It's a gin with a little bit of cucumber. I've done one where it's fresh cucumber, just chopped, then I make cucumber juice, and then chives, and muddle that together. And then Hendrix gin, some kosher salt, fresh cracked pepper, and just makes a really, really, a little splash of soda, really refreshing. But the herbs and the gin... You know, kind of brings out the aromatics and whatnot. We just started getting cherries last week. They're amazing. I mean, Michigan cherries are my favorite anyway.
Yeah, that's where I'm from. I grew up in Detroit, so we used to go to Traverse City every year for the big cherry festival.
Awesome.
It's like a rite of passage.
Yeah. So one I'll definitely do tonight is a black cherry caipirinha.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with caipirinha?
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably my only real understanding of where cachaça is used.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of the standard, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, just a classic caipirinha, but you add some pitted black cherries, and it's like insanely good.
Mm-hmm.
You get the really beautiful color, and then we serve them with a cocktail pick, because everyone, when they're done with a drink, they're like picking out the cherry skins.
So have you ever just come to the market, seen something, and just said, this is what I'm doing today? That's probably how you operate a lot, I bet.
Yeah, that's how I like when I cook. I like to just go and see whether it's a farmer's market or just a supermarket. I like to go and see, you know, what meat looks the best or fish or what produce, and then kind of build the menu around that. Just because if the ingredients are really great quality, you can do so much more with them.
I know you talked a little bit about writing books geared towards cooking with alcohol, cooking with spirits. I think the common wisdom or the thing you always hear about is, you know, like Charlie Trotter doesn't serve spirits because it deadens the palate. Or yeah, I'm curious about what your take on that is. Is that, I mean, I suppose if you drink a lot, but even if you drink some, does it have an effect on the palate? Do you feel, I mean, you were talking earlier about how you got an idea from a dish, and you know, but I'm curious about your take on that or what you're talking about.
No, I think if you have before a meal a well-balanced cocktail, mm-hmm. that it's if it's anything, it relaxes you, mm-hmm. and man, it's not going to hurt your palate. Certainly, I'm not one who generally drinks cocktails all the way through dinner. I like to start off with a cocktail and then have wine with dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's well balanced and it's, you know, great ingredients, I think it's part of the experience of a great, you know, great meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like the progression. You start out with the cocktail, mm-hmm. and move into the wine and that kind of.
Right.
It's almost like it's an amuse of or the liquor amuse.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're starting off with, you know, a straight vodka or whatever, yeah, that's going to affect your palate.
Yeah.
But you know, if you've got something with fresh herbs or juices and, you know, nice acid balance, and then that's not going to hurt you at all.
Mm-hmm.
Been having some fun with basil. Did, I'm pretty sure we're done with, well, they might have some strawberries left, but just doing a strawberry basil balsamic mojito.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think I might do. I think it would work with a cachaça because I was using rum for it. So,
mm-hmm.
But kind of taking the idea of balsamic and strawberries being a real classic combination. And then I use brown sugar instead of simple syrup because I just like that flavor, a little bit of that molassesy, mm-hmm. with the strawberries. And then
will you like macerate the strawberries in balsamic, or how?
No, I just put them put the strawberries in and the brown sugar, and just muddle that all together with the mint and the limes, and then the balsamic, I just finish off a splash at the end. Almost like I like a little bit of Angostura bitters,
mm-hmm.
in my mojito. I think that adds some complexity and bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
And the balsamic, to me, I use that instead of the Angostura.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of checking stuff out.
Hey, Nick.
Hey,
how's it going?
Good, how are you guys?
Good, hey.
Good.
Has Randy been by yet?
Yep.
Did he pick up cherries and...
Cherries, a flat of cherries, a little asparagus, some strawberries I think he had.
Okay.
Red raspberries, I think. Randy.
Okay, cool.
All right.
I just need to get a little bit of rhubarb.
Okay, I'll get it. I'll be right there.
Okay.
You just smell the strawberries,
yeah,
coming up. So I had read that you're a seasonal guy with drinks, you know, very much like chefs, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that was interesting, I was reading about you were getting sous vide purees, and then in the winter time, or is that?
Yeah. It's
Can I talk to you? Actually?
Sure. Oh, okay.
I just need 6 socks of rhubarb and 1 thing of blueberry.
Okay.
Yeah, it's actually this this guy out of the UK. It's called Funkin Purees, and I call them the George Jetson packs because it's basically it's like sous vide, and they're not frozen and they're not cooked, but it just as close to like, you know, fresh purees as it gets. Get a lychee from him. It's incredible. I mean, it's like just squeeze your own lychees. But we'll do. I'll kind of look at what, you know, what's in season around the world. And that's one of the things with. Have you had Capriole cheese before?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, all the time.
Awesome.
I love it. Love it. Her strawberries were really good last week, too, actually. These were my favorites last week.
Yeah, I think you're going to have. It's too early, unfortunately, for peaches.
Yeah.
But there's a drink called the. Batita,
uh-huh.
and it's basically like a shaken daiquiri,
uh-huh.
Would be Brazilian. You just take, you'd use just about any fruit, and you chop it, and then lime juice and simple syrup and cachaça and crushed ice, and then shake it.
Uh-huh.
And so the thing I love about batitas is when you do a frozen daiquiri, everything's so pureed, you don't get any texture,
uh-huh.
and with a batita, you get, you know, the texture of the fruit.
Uh-huh.
We get these. There's this guy later in the summer from Indiana who was He's got patents on like 70 different peaches. The guy is a complete peach dork. And he's got this.
Are these like heirloom varieties and things like that, or stuff he's engineered?
No, these are ones that he's genetically engineered. And he's got one that's flaming something peach. And I mean, they're just out of control, sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just pit them and peel them and chop them and would just macerate them in either cachaça or rum. And you get this great kind of kind of peach liqueur almost from them. And then we'd use the peaches also like in batidas.
Uh-huh.
These people have some really cool stuff. She's got, they've got, it's called land cress. And it's like watercress, but it's grown on the land, and they grow them in Grant Park. They have it really, really peppery.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking about doing this, an heirloom tomato drink. Kind of twist on a mojito, mm-hmm. but using like, I did a little bit of this last week. I got some of her spicy cress and some green tomatoes. Really, really interesting. So I'm thinking that might be fun to try. So let's get a couple tomatoes. Yeah, because I'll use like a green tomato kind of as a, for the acidity.
I've been going to a lot of markets around the country lately. Mm-hmm. I've just been traveling a lot, and I just got back from Montreal. So
oh, wow.
Jean Talon and the Atwater markets there, and you know, even Cleveland, the West Side market there. And I mean, this is some of the best produce out there. You know,
yeah.
Because they're so stringent here, but it's like, you know, it's insane how these cities have these built-in, like, you know, all year-round markets. And it's like, and granted, a lot of this stuff isn't seasonal, but,
mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of these guys growing hoopa stuff and root veg and things like that. And
yeah.
It seems like it would be nice if we had something like that in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I was talking to Alpana Singh.
Uh-huh.
And she was telling me about, there was a pig roast on a fifth floor balcony. And, I think she said she was like, well, you know, the balcony is like 4 foot by 3 foot, so you do the math.
Yeah, it was like 3/4 pig roaster. We got a 50-pound heirloom pig.
Uh-huh.
And it was literally an hour and a half. The 50-pound pig was like gnawed to the bone. It was uh-huh. It was insane.
How'd you do it? Was it just like smoke, low smoke?
No, it was
spit roast?
No, it was imagine like this big box about the size of that picnic table.
Uh-huh.
And where the pig split, and then you put the pig in there, and then you have this grate that goes on top, and you put the charcoal is actually on top of it.
Yeah.
So it creates like this pressure cooker. And I cooked the whole pig in like 3 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Just, oh, so... so good.
No concerns about burning down the building?
Yeah, I don't think his kind of association knew about it. So it was definitely living on the edge a little bit. Do you have any of the land cress today?
I do not.
What was the closest as far as like really kind of peppery?
Was the arugula or the red mustard.
Okay. So it's called Japanese mustard or red mustard?
These are both two different kinds of Japanese mustards.
Okay.
This is a red mustard.
Okay.
This is Mizuna. You usually see it, you know, this is familiar, right?
Mm-hmm.
You sell it.
Yeah.
But they're both spicy.
Cool. Do you mind if I pick through a little bit of the red?
Nope.
I feel like I just discovered my new favorite drink.
Yeah.
What are you using for?
This, if you come here next week, she has this land cress.
Uh-huh.
It's like the same kind of flavor profile. It's,
mm-hmm. I have to check it out. I try to make it here usually once a week. So.
You can actually.
It seems to be this cocktail thing is a passion for you and mm-hmm. the undercurrent of what you're doing. When was there sort of like a definitive moment for you there early on, or is it something you've always been doing? Or?
I did some bartending when I was in college
mm-hmm.
at Cornell, and I was just learning like really just the classics. This guy named
is the bar still there?
Yeah, it's actually the hotel that the Statler Hotel, the Cornell Hotel School runs. And Bud, the guy who opened it and trained me, I was just there with Randy and I did a guest chef event, and Bud was still the bartender. You know, Cornell,
nice.
So it was kind of cool.
Nice, some things don't change.
But that was just learning, you know, just, you know, really just classic bartending. And my dad used to bartend, so, you know, there's always a little bit of that. You know, it's kind of cool your dad did this. And than when I was in Louisville.
Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in Baton Rouge.
Okay.
Up to eighth grade, and then was in high school in New York, and then college at Cornell. But when I lived in Louisville, I was at a place called the Sealbach. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like the Drake, kind of turn of the century, big grand hotel. And whenever I had friends in town, I'd go to this place called Hasenauer's. So there's this old bartender there named Max. And he was like this, a living, breathing bourbon encyclopedia. The guy, his knowledge was just unbelievable. And so I'd go there, and he would do like bourbon tastings for us and just learn so much about bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Hasenauer's. They closed. But the place had been around since pre-Prohibition, and great bourbon list. And these, it was, Max was a bartender, then Bill Altman was his boss. And Max was a third-generation bartender. His dad was named Max. His grandfather was named Max. He had a son who was a bartender named Max Jr. And Hasenauer's ended up closing for the owner for tax evasion.
Yeah.
And so I managed to get a hold of, I was asking around, how can I get a hold of Max? Because I would love, you know, to hire him for the Oak Room, for the hotel. And I got a hold of this guy named, well, they said, call Bill Altman. He'll know how to get a hold of Max. So I called Bill, and I said, you know, he's a regular at Hasenauer's and direct restaurant in the Sealbach, and I'm trying to get a hold of Max, see if he's interested in a bartending job. And Bill's like, well, I can get a message to Max, but I was Max's boss, and I'm looking for a job as well, because the restaurant closed. So I ended up hiring both of these guys. They're both in their 60s, and I mean, Max is just really learned, like, classic mixology from him,
uh-huh.
and started working a little bit with kind of, we developed some of our own drinks together, but really wasn't doing anything market driven or seasonal wise. It was just kind of
just learning, getting
kind of like really getting the classics foundation. But Max was just, he was learned like really good technique as far as exactly how to properly chill a drink with having it diluted enough proof-wise, but not be too diluted as far as exactly, like, the way he taught me to shake. I don't like these, you see the Boston shakers, the one that have, like, the rubber around them?
Are they the ones that,
They're like a two-piece shaker. You've got
the glass,
the metal.
Yeah.
But a lot of bartenders are using these ones that it's got like, rubber around them.
So you can hold on.
So it doesn't get cold on your hand.
Yeah, insulation.
But you also can't tell
what's
happening.
I mean, it was fine.
And so I like just the standard, the metal ones, because what Max taught me is when the shaker is frosted, that's like the perfect combination of, you know, it's chilled, but it's not going to be too diluted.
Yeah.
And so you don't get that with the, but just, you know, I learned kind of things like that. And then I learned, like, about all the spirits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his knowledge of this bourbon, vodka, whiskey, rye, everything was really, really incredible. So I got a really strong foundation there. And then I think it was really at Nacional that the restaurant already had a very good cocktail program when I got there and was already committed to fresh juices.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started to kind of expand it from there and expanding the list.
Oh.
It was actually, I took a kind of a cocktail trip to London. Spent a week there and hit every important bar. I mean, it was from Lab Bar to Salvatore's and Zeta Bar at the London Hilton, which has, they have their own juice kitchen for the bar. It's about the size of this, like, area. It's not that big. But two prep guys, all they do is make juices and prep fruit for the bar. I mean, it's
nice.
Insane. And just all the bar, I was going around with a guy who's the president of Funkin', the puree company. And so he was in all the top bars. He took me everywhere. And we went to a lot of them before they were open. And one thing I saw is produce deliveries to bars that looked like restaurant deliveries at all the good places. And then I started thinking about, and then, you know, with Randy cooking from the market in the summers, and I got this idea of doing this market, you know, cocktail list.
Uh-huh.
And so we started it right when I got back from London, and started with, I think, blood oranges, because we were getting those out of California in, like, February, March. and then passion fruit. It's passion fruit season in New Zealand. And then we're then grapes from Chile, because their harvest is in the spring. And then rhubarb was the first thing we got here. And then now, you know, the summer's just like tons of stuff.
Yeah. But is England sort of a mecca for drinks or bars?
London is, London? Definitely.
Yeah. Because I know, you know, it's like if you're in the beer community, it's like Belgium or, you know, some places in Germany. And, you know, it's like, so England is sort of, or London is ground zero.
London is it. Yeah. It's definitely. Well, there's a couple of things. One, the per capita beverage consumption in London is very high. But the economy, everywhere you went, cocktails are pretty much standard £10, which is about $18. And so, but the economy is so strong there, it's supporting all these very, very high-end places that, one, they can afford to use absolutely the best ingredients, but two, you're paying $18 for a drink. I don't want to see roses lime. I don't want to see something come out of a gun. You know, you want everything is...
Yeah.
So, but what I've kind of seen is what's happening in London, cocktail-wise, you see come to New York about a year, year and a half later, and then Chicago is about a year, year and a half behind New York. So my idea was go to London, see what's happening there, bring that back to Chicago, and I'll be ahead of what anybody else is doing.
Uh-huh.
I just got a lot of inspiration. But that's kind of the one of the things I wrote down in my list was, you know, this kind of market cocktail list, and just like a chef does, and just think about, like, let's see what's in season and then create the drinks around that.
How does the market embrace it? I mean, it seems like, you know, we're still, especially, you know, in Chicago, we're still very much a, you know, Jack and Coke culture, you know, gin and tonic, or, you know, you don't even call it out or whatever. And, you know, are people, you know, people who come to Nacional, are they like, oh man, this is incredible? And is it something where you're still sort of acting as like a guide or a liaison to like get people into these kind of things? Or
there's definitely, I mean, there's you get the people who are really into it, and those are easy and fun, and then you definitely get the Jack and Coke crowd that it's fun to kind of get them to try something new. So that's where we've been doing a lot of miniature cocktails and cocktail flights, and that's you know, so someone that hasn't had a mojito before, you know, have $5 mini mojito.
Uh-huh.
I mean, big deal. It's the same price as a beer.
Uh-huh.
See if you like it, and that kind of gets them in, and then get them to try that. Okay, now you like that. Try like a pomegranate ginger chili mojito, or you know, try a caipirinha. And you know, cachaça is really just a clear rum.
Right.
You know, sounds a little bit more exotic. But there's definitely a lot of like education, having people taste, and then.
Uh-huh. Is there like a group of people, like a culture of people who are just as crazy about cocktails? I mean, obviously there is, because, you know, but, I mean, do you have, like, people that come, like, groups of people to, like, Nacional to, you know, try your stuff who are just, like, you know, it's kind of like mecca, you know, like, people go to the French Laundry if they're foodies, or, you know, people, you know, do you have some sense of that? Is there?
Oh, definitely. I mean, everyone in my sommelier group, they're all...
Is that the Blind Tasters?
Chicago Blind Tasters. Yeah, they all, Nacional is kind of their place to come for drinks.
Yeah. Are you, so. And you're going to do the Master Sommelier exam, right?
For hopefully 07.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the game plan? How do you prepare for that? I mean, you just taste, right?
Well, a lot of tasting, it's a lot of studying as well. Well, I blind taste once a week with our group, and we're starting to kind of, there's four of us who are at the advanced level that want to take the master's, so we're kind of gearing up to like twice a week now, and then the next thing is like a lot of just theory studying and a lot of online research, because you're expected to know all the new laws that aren't yet out in print on the wine books and stuff.
How would you set that up? You just like have somebody pour and...
No, each of us brings a bottle blind, and so we follow the quartermaster sommelier's format, which is 4 minutes and 15 seconds per wine, and you got a checklist of about 35 items that you have to like kind of go through, and then you have a pre-conclusion, which is old world or new world, possible grape varietals, age range, quality level, and then country, and then you do your final conclusion. You have to say let's say, for instance, I've got a, let's say I've got a white wine, and I'm picking up a lot of, say, a lot of flint and like tree fruits and lemon and very little wood, little vanilla. Then I'd say, okay, and really good acidity. Then initial conclusion would be Old World because of the acidity and low use of not a lot of wood and cool climate because of the acidity. Possible grape varietals, I would say probably be like Chardonnay, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Grigio. And then final conclusion you go into would be like, okay, France, Chablis, Chardonnay. You know, then you would say a vintage. You have to know your vintages. So if it was like a more fruit forward, I'd say maybe 2003 is a hotter vintage, or if it was more acidity, then say probably 2002, depending on like the color and the hues. If you look at it, if it has some green tints, usually it's younger than maybe like 2004.
Today,
it's insane.
Would it be, would they be, I don't know what the word is, vicious enough to pull out an exception to a vintage, you know, like.
No, they very much
try
everything.
To go with the style.
They want things that are very typical and very classic.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we try and bring, things that are very typical to that variety or to that appellation. We'll do like kind of random blind, and we'll also do ones where we'll say, okay, we're going to do Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone bring one New World and one Old World Riesling, or Sauvignon Blanc, or Pinot Noir, whatever the grape varietal is. Those are really, really helpful. Because then you have an imprint of like a grape. And even though there's all kinds of different styles, depending whether it's Australia, or New Zealand, or France, or Germany, or whatever, that's really helpful.
So do you get partial credit for the...
You get...
For your the preliminaries you were talking about?
Yeah, in order to pass, you have to show the math. You can guess the wine perfectly, but if you don't show the math, then. But you can also.
So there's six, right? Or something,
yeah.
On the final.
You have to get, for the master level, you have to get four.
Okay.
75%.
Okay.
The advanced level is 60% for pass. So it's.
That's awesome, man.
It's insane.
It is. It really is.
So I read that you make your own bitters. Is that?
Yeah, that was an interesting project.
Yeah.
Because I'm a big fan of bitters, I just think it adds, you know, great. I think it's just important in a drink.
Sure.
It adds
one of
the back palate and there. Aromatics. And
a lot of people probably rely on quinine in the tonic sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
Over bitters.
But it was really interesting. The thing about bitters is the like Angostura and Peychaud's and whatnot, the big ones. Their recipes are and ingredients are so secretive that I did a ton of research on the internet and just, I mean, you can find orange bitters recipes, but that's about it. But it was really hard kind of finding much out there. And I got turned on to this place called Merck's Apothecary up in Lincoln Square.
Mm-hmm.
It's been around since the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody kind of calls it the witchcraft store. Because they've got all these different herbs and stuff that looks like, you know, you're doing some, like,
but it's not.
I mean, there's like crazy stuff up there. I mean, you can buy wormwood, everything.
Okay. So you can hook up the old absinthe.
Yeah. So I did, yeah, I went up there. I spent like half a day in there just going through botanical books and reading about all these different herbs. And they have, they had a Swedish bitters herb mix. There was about 13 different herbs. The Swedish bitters are used a lot as kind of a tonic, just summer tonic. So I got that, and then
the
I...
Bitter started out as a digestif, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that? And the ones that are left over kind of the tail end.
Exactly. Yeah, and cocktail bitter just kind of grew out of that. But it was really interesting. I ended up with 27 ingredients, different infusions. And I did, depending on what the herb was, I did a different infusion. So I used Madeira, tequila, rum were the main like things I used to infuse with, and did everything for suppose I could tell it was like a 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
A fortnight was like kind of the for Swedish bitters and whatnot seemed to like to be the right time for extract. So I had in the office Because I had this in the office. I didn't want it to be on the bar because I didn't know if the health inspector came in. It was kind of weird.
Sure.
But I had all these mason jars, and they're all like this black gunk, you know, like brewing away in them. And I went, Chef and I had a trip to San Francisco, hit some restaurants, and I had my assistant. I was calling back each day. Did you remember to shake the bitters? Because you had to like shake it twice a day. And then it was really interesting because then I had to, then I put them through a coffee filter.
So were you trying to go for a particular flavor profile?
I wanted to be somewhere between Peychaud's and Angostura. I wanted a little bit darker color than Peychaud's, a little lighter than Angostura, but I wanted the same level of bitterness. And you can't really taste bitters straight because they're just fry your palate. So it was kind of, that was interesting mixing it because, and this was like $180 worth of stuff just from the apothecary plus all this booze. So I had a lot of money invested in it, having no idea if this was going to work or not. And so I basically diluted everything by 100 and tasted them separately and then did like a micro blend. And then I diluted Peychaud's and Angostura the same way and did like a micro blend and then came up with the ratios and then I did one big batch.
Nice.
But I was really psyched the way it came out. I'm going to tweak a couple of things in the next recipe, but I got a little nervous. I've got a friend who's he's an anesthesiologist and he's also kind of a beverage geek and he did some FDA research because there was some stuff put in there and wasn't sure exactly how legal. But the real interesting thing was
is it has hallucinogenic properties too.
Well, there's I did get some wormwood.
Nice.
The general consensus is absinthe is 130 proof and it's made from cheap booze. That's going to kill you before you have enough wormwood to do anything to you. But you can buy wormwood over the counter. I'm like Whole Foods has it. And so I wrote the FDA and read all the statutes about absinthe being illegal, and the FDA's got this huge big thing about wormwood, but it's legal. What is it? It's legal as a dietary supplement, but not as a food additive. It's just as weird. This antiquated.
Yeah. Have you ever tried doing any absinthe and like distilling it, or is that impossible?
No, it's actually pretty easy to make.
Have you ever had it? Like, the real deal?
Yeah, I brought some back. It's legal, and as of a couple years ago, it's legal in England again, so I brought some back.
Don't they say, like, that manufacturer is different than what they were turning out, like, back in...
Where they're turning out before, it was just really bad spirits.
So you have, like, their favorite spirits that you just return to that are always...
Bourbon.
Bourbon?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
What's your favorite bourbon? Our favorite bourbons. That's probably the child asking to be your favorite children.
I like Elijah Craig, 18-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
He's just amazing.
What do you think about sort of the new movement of, of course there's science food. Now there's like science cocktails. You know, I know they're doing some acid-based stuff over at Modo. And I don't know if Grant's doing anything. But, you know, that whole thing, is that something that interests you, or are you more about the purity of, you know, spirits and fruit?
No, it definitely interests me as long as, at the end of the day, that the flavor is, that the taste of the drink is solid. And I think, like Grant, when he was at Trio, I went and did his 20-course tour de force, and it was like probably 10 dishes that were like really cool and solid, and there are 10 that were just like, I think he just did for the, like he did this Caesar salad granita, which to this day is probably one of the worst flavor memories, texture, everything was bad. It was like that bad lettuce that got semi-frozen in the cooler camping and it was squashy. But then I think at Alinea, his cooking has matured so much. And I think the biggest thing is there's definitely still that wow in presentation and the, you know, molecular whatever. But at the end of the day, at Alinea, it's the food, it's great ingredients, and they taste great, and they're super cool.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I don't know, this guy Evan, who does the drinks for Be Our Guest, he did like the J-Bar and the James Hotel list.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing some cool stuff he's kind of experimenting with. He did a blue cheese lollipop.
Yeah, I heard about
it. It was like
that.
An olive lollipop with blue cheese inside, which was really cool. And then I started experimenting a little bit, if you add... baking soda to like lime juice. You get this really great foam. So I did a drink for actually for the Eiffel Tower in Las Vegas because it was, I thought it was really kind of Vegas thing. And it was apple cider and Calvados. I think I put the a little bit of the baking soda on in there. Oh, and then I had what was sweet, molasses or something, and I hit it with like a little bit of a lime and went into lime, and it gave the great foam. I was just reading online, Bowls, B-O-L-S. No, no, Bowls, the cordial company.
Okay.
They've got an amazing website, and just going through, just kind of seeing, because it's very international of what's going on, but they're talking about this guy in Paris who's kind of doing some of this, the molecular cooking, but starting to do it with drinks. Had some guys in from, the sommeliers actually from Alinea are all kind of regulars at Nasty now, because they're closed on Mondays and Tuesdays. And been talking to them about different things that they've been experimenting with, these different, I'm trying to think what you call them. You can take like a liquid and suspend it in this little ball, and then, but they're doing this, they only last for like 15 minutes or so. And it, I know at Moto and Alinea they've done things with it that you can have like a soup inside of this little, almost like a soup M&M or something. So they're kind of experimenting that with some drinks. So I haven't done a lot of it, but.
What's your commitment or your vision for what you want to do with or cocktails in the future? I mean, how you think about it when you wake up to inspire yourself or, you know, go to the next level? Or do you just let serendipity kind of take its course? I
mean,
basically just trying to, you know, people are always like, if it's not broke, break it, I think Charlie Trotter's like always talking about how, you know, he doesn't serve the same dish twice because you want to build and you always want, there's always something new to try. I don't know.
Kind of two directions. One is just to continue like tasting new things and then thinking of what I can do with that with drinks, like trying that Japanese red mustard. I mean, that's just fun of like, now I'm going to go and try this with some different flavor and see what happens. And see, you know, I love things that are, like when I first told people strawberry basil balsamic mojito, and they're like, what the are you doing? And like, people love them. It's an incredible drink. But it's kind of fun to like, you know, you go backwards and think about it. You know, it makes sense. But then also the other thing is, I do a lot of things that are homemade. At Nacional, which I love to make. I mean, I've got four different liqueurs I make. I make the bitters, all these different syrups and whatnot, which I think is kind of cool because then it's something that you come to Nacional, you can only get Liqueur 27, Nacional 27. You can only get my bitters there. And I think that's part of the appeal of going to a restaurant of something that you can't make at home. But then the double-edged sword and the other thing is trying to then translate that to things that, you know, people want to be able to go home and make one of these cocktails. So that's kind of an exciting challenge and figuring out how to still come out with a great drink that has integrity but doesn't take, you know, 2 weeks and $180 of stuff at an apothecary to make, you know, the bitters for it. I mean, like I did a Pisco contest for Pisco Capel brandy from Peru. And we're selecting one bartender from Chicago, from each city that has the United States Bartenders Guild, but the parameters were nothing homemade and only five ingredients, including like bitters or anything. So that was kind of like, because from their company standpoint, they want a great cocktail that they can promote, that can be made in bars all over the place. So that was kind of fun challenging of getting something that was really complex and balanced with just five ingredients without making something homemade. That's kind of a fun challenge. I mean, it's kind of
constraints
like,
make you think, right? That's,
yeah.
I mean, architects always say the best architecture comes out of, you know, the zoning codes and things that you have to avoid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's, and you know, finding an ingredient that maybe isn't something you'd normally use and make it something great is, like I did, Starbucks has these two liqueurs, their cream liqueur and their coffee liqueur. And I don't have them in Nacional because I make my own coffee liqueur. It doesn't make sense. But they're doing a drink contest. And so that was cool because I wanted something that... So I ended up with... I tried doing it with the two liqueurs and some stout. Because I always think a stout is kind of coffee-ish. And the flavor was awesome, but the acid from the beer broke the cream. And it was just...
It was like curdled.
It looked terrible. So I ended up...
It was like an Irish car bomb going around.
Yeah, exactly. I ended up using mezcal.
Oh.
Because it's got that smokiness.
Yeah.
And because Starbucks always, to me, always has a, like kind of that roasted smoky.
Yeah.
And I did...
And the beans are probably provenance from somewhere in Mexico or South America.
Yeah, and it's awesome. It's like 3/4 ounces of the cream, so the Starbucks cream, 3/4 ounces of the coffee, an ounce of the mezcal, and then about 1/2 ounce of Frangelico for hazelnut. And it's like cream, coffee, smoky, nutty, but everything in balance. And then I did a salted cinnamon sugar rim. So that salt kind of like, you know, made the mezcal pop, and then the cinnamon and the sugar kind of, it's really complex. So that was fun because it's like, all right, I have to use these two liqueurs, and you've got these parameters. And then there's also the, you know, coming to the market, and it's like, oh, cool, there's some fresh lavender. And I go back to the bar, and I've got 200 different bottles of different stuff, and there's, like, no limits at all. So it's, they're two different school of thoughts, but I love both of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had the, was it the Long Shot or whatever it was? Is that right?
The Kentucky
it was
Long
like
Shot?
The Breeders' Cup?
Uh-huh.
No, it was the official drink. How did that come about?
That was, the Courier Journal, the newspaper down there, did that, and actually Max and I came up with that together.
Okay.
And it became...
Is he sort of your big influence? Is he the guy that was really...
Mm-hmm.
If you had to point to one, or...
I definitely, as a mixologist, yeah. Just because, real, very passionate, and always reading, always learning. And that's something I definitely took from Max. It's like, you never stop learning. I think if you look at any great chef, I mean, there's not like, okay, I've arrived. It's like you're always evolving. Because the other thing is when you start doing something and you start getting some attention, then you have hopefully inspiring other people and they're starting to do what you're doing. And so you've got to kind of keep ahead of the curve and keep, reinventing yourself and never getting... kind of resting.
Now, do you have peers right now that you kind of look to, or you compete against, or you just play off of? That you?
Francesco Lafranconi, definitely great mentor.
Uh-huh.
He's won the Martini Bacardi World Cup in 2001, which is.
And you trained with him, right? Is that right?
Yeah. And then Bridget Albert, who was trained by Francesco. She's the mixologist for Southern Wine and Spirits, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
Dale DeGroff, definitely one I look for, especially the classics. I'm always going to his website, and if I'm working on a drink, I'll look at Dale's recipe of like say with this Pisco contest. I went through and looked through all his Pisco recipes and just wrote down a list of all the different ingredients. And so, okay, these are, I know, flavor profiles that'll work, and then I came up with my own kind of thing. Those were probably the big ones, Francesco and Dale.
Mm-hmm. What about the other thing, you know, cocktail culture, you know, it's alcohol, and so I'd imagine there's a lot of good stories or things that, you know, as a result of being part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if anything stands out or there's like a moment or moments for you, you know, surrounding that. You know, I always say, like, you know, the thing for me for writing about food is, sometimes, or a lot of times, it's not about the food. It's food is almost the backdrop. You know, it's the backdrop for, you know, gathering friends and family, or you know, meeting new people, or whatever it is. And you know, drinking is sort of like that. You know,
it's a very social.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the beauty to me with mixology is it's kind of like the ultimate open kitchen. Because you're on that side of the bar, I'm on this side of the bar, and I've got all these. And you can customize your customer's drink. They see you making it. You're talking to them. You know, it's a very two-way kind of thing. And it'd be almost like if you could go and stand at the pass at the French Laundry and say, Thomas, okay, I see. Can you make this for me? Can you use this? Can you use this?
Yeah.
And I want this sauce. I mean, to me, that's what a bar chef is. And that's, yeah. I think any chef, one of the things that besides... you know, enjoying the flavor of something you create, it's that feedback that you created something that someone really enjoyed. And you get more instant feedback when the person is right there and they're making it fun of you.
Uh-huh. Do you find that, you know, there's a, sort of the idea of the bartender as like the armchair therapist or the person that people, you know, go to sometimes, you know, it's like the stereotype, I think, but I mean, do you find that you've played that role at times, or do you find that that happens at all, or is that just
no.
a myth?
No, it's not a myth. It's definitely not one of the roles that I take.
Yeah.
I usually don't stand still long enough to like, right. I need to be moving or doing something. And it's more talking about what they want to drink or what they want to taste than kind of the therapy thing.
Yeah.
My therapy is like, whatever's going on in your life, you can have the most insanely delicious cocktail, and like, who cares?
Yeah. And then if you have enough, you'll forget. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Hungry Magazine. As always, we're looking for feedback and suggestions on chefs and topics you want to see covered. Send your feedback to mjnagran@hungrymag.com. Have a good week, stay cool, and most of all, stay hungry.
Four, three, two. One more time.